She hates depositions that start before noon. And she doesn't like trials unless they're in June. She thinks most judges are just big buffoons. That's why the lawyer is a champ. She won't take on clients who can't pay their bills.
Good morning. Welcome to Criminal Justice Insider. I'm Babs Rawls-Ivey, and that's Jeff Grant.
Hey, Babs.
And we're going to get some music right at some point. I don't like that music. We're going to find some music that I like. Today in our studios, we've got Amy.
Amy Smoyer.
Amy Smoyer.
And Jackie Lucibello. Lucibello?
Yes, Lucibello.
Lucibello.
Who I've been stalking for quite some time because I've been wanting to go to the women's work.
Working group?
The
working
Women's group. Resettlement Working Group.
Yes, thank you, girl. So I've been trying to get to that meeting. So this is the next best thing to getting to that meeting. And so since Jeff and I started doing this show, you know, we're trying to pull all the criminal justice folks that we know into one room to have these big conversations. So welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
So Jeff and I are going to catch up a few things before we get started. If y'all are familiar with us and you're listening, you can call in. And the call-in number is, I don't know, Jeff likes the call-in part. I don't like the call-in part.
Yeah, we do have a call-in number here.
We do have a call-in number somewhere on this page that I can tell you it. I never know it by heart because I don't use it. And then I wanted to...
I got it.
Okay,
say 203-872-7356. But only if you're listening at 9 a.m. in the morning. If it's rebroadcast, we're not going to pick up.
We're not going to pick up. And this show is brought to you by the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven, now more than ever, and Family Reentry. I know there's a tagline for Family Reentry, but I don't see it.
Serving the justice community since 1984.
And that's good, Jeff.
Nice middle of the road.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes, we like that.
Yep.
And we have a Facebook page. So if you want to know what's happening around criminal justice all around the world and the country, we have a Facebook page and we keep stuff and a Twitter feed. So we keep information flowing, which is really nice because we can't talk about everything that we share. So if you're out there and you want to know what's happening in other parts or you want to know some innovative stuff going on, check out the Criminal Justice Insider Facebook page. It's chock full of information on the regular. Let me tell you, Jeff is the master social media maven.
That's because I have no life, Babs.
Jeff has a really big life, but you know. So he stays on top of all that. But he's in the know of all these things that's going around the country, around who's doing what in the arena of social justice. And social justice is very hot right now. In the last couple of years, I mean, there's been, you know, since the jump off of Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, everybody has been sort of amped up about criminal justice and what that looks like. The for-profit prisons, the complex.
Prison industrial complex.
Yes, everybody's looking at that. Yep. And then everybody's trying to figure out what to do with reentry. What happens to people when they come out?
Yep.
What happens to them? Are they just numbers?
Yep.
You know, what happens to their lives? We want to know them all. So Jeff and I decided that this would be the vehicle that we would use to sort of go in depth and find out what's happening with people in this.
And deep into their stories. I mean, what brings us all into this room together and as people and people who've suffered oppression and marginalization and had failures and successes and what brings us all together at the same time? I think that's an important conversation to, at least a conversation starter to put out there so we find out, you know, that we're all humans and we've been led here. So I think that's the basic purpose of the radio show, in case you didn't know.
So. Yes. So thank you for being our guest. Shout out to Family Reentry. They got two pieces in the newspaper, one about all this budget cutting stuff and how this is going to affect nonprofits. And y'all are talking about that in the Connecticut Post and something else on the Connecticut Mirror.
We had an article in the we were interviewed for an article in the Post and an article for in the Mirror.
Okay,
and I was at the Connecticut Nonprofit Alliance event, the conference up in Hartford yesterday, and people were coming up to me and said that we saw you in the paper twice in the last week. That's amazing. And I said to them, well, you know, about 15 years ago, I was in the paper a lot more than that.
That's true. And if Andrew is listening, good morning, Andrew. We love you and thinking about you. And we'll see you soon.
Andrew's our mascot.
He's our guy. So, all right. So, women, ladies, tell us about the work that you do and why you're doing it. Because I was on your site, Amy, looking at all the stuff that you've done far and wide. And it's quite impressive.
Yeah,
what brings you to this?
What led you to this work?
All right. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Jeff and Babs, for inviting us here today. And I hope that I look forward to talking with you about a lot of things, especially as Babs was saying, we have a big conversation about justice in this country. And one of the things that Jackie and I are trying to do is bring the focus of that conversation to women and women's lives.
Yes.
Because over 90% of the people who are incarcerated in this country are men. So it does make sense that a lot of times when people think about prison and justice-involved people, they think of men. Mm-hmm. But it also impacts women. And mm-hmm. so we really want to, you know, focus on that mm-hmm. and talk about that. Also just want to give a shout out for today is World AIDS Day.
Yes.
We really come with that spirit, which is a spirit of love and activism. Mm-hmm. And hope.
Yes.
You know, and absolutely. That's what this day really captures
and
for us.
And we see you wearing your orange sweatshirt. I hope that wasn't in our honor.
It's a red sweater.
Oh, sorry.
Which is the color for HIV. And it's designed from Keith Haring, who was an amazing AIDS activist, artist, person living with HIV, person who died of AIDS, and a gay man. And
yes.
so we remember him and others who we've lost on this day. Mm-hmm. So really my story about how I got involved in this issue actually connects to this issue of HIV. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a very liberal white household talking about the revolution, as Tracy Chapman would say. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the way I was raised. And when I graduated from high school, I wanted to go to New York City because that was where things were happening and people were fighting and being involved and changing the world. So when I landed in New York City, it was 1987. Mm. And what was going on in New York City? Well, a lot of things were going on. The city was bankrupt. I mean, there was like crack thing was going on and everything. One thing that was happening is there were a lot of people living with HIV and fighting HIV. And there was a lot of fear and dying and dying of HIV. And I think for those of us who lived through that era, we will never forget it. And so for me, as somebody who was a women's studies major, who was thinking about gender, race, homophobia, this movement really caught my attention and brought me into the kind of social change that I was interested in. So I spent the first 5 or 10 years of my career as an HIV activist and social worker with gay men, mostly white gay men. And over time, that practice changed, and I became more and more involved with people who injected drugs. Mm-hmm. And in this country, when you spend time with people who use drugs, you go to jail.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's what happens.
Yep.
And so because of my class and my class and race privileges, really I'd been protected from this huge criminal justice system my whole life. And mm-hmm. so I was in my early 30s when I first stepped into a prison in relationship to my HIV work, because my clients were there and, you know, and the people I was working with. And just going into that place and looking around and being like, what is going on here? Mm-hmm. You know, and just being really... And that from there became, so it was actually through my work with people living with HIV that I became involved in thinking about criminal justice and how we use those systems. And right now, you know, fast forward now, among the many things I do, I am an assistant professor of social work at Southern Connecticut State. And one of the things I do is run the group for HIV positive women at the York Correctional Facility.
That's beautiful.
And it's an honor to be there, and a full circle back to the work that and the people that brought me into this movement in the beginning.
Okay. Yeah. And now talk a little bit. Now, Jackie, tell us a little bit how you got into this business, this work.
I got into this work. I've always sort of been in the human services field. Again, my passion was HIV AIDS because both of my parents had it and passed away due to complications. Mm. But what really got me connected with Amy is that I was incarcerated. I did 3 years in New York due to a heroin addiction. And when I came home, again, there was just a lack of services and support for women. And I just couldn't imagine how I had a difficult time, and I had family support. And I couldn't imagine how other women could reenter and successfully, mm-hmm. especially with children. So I started making connections, and I was told to go to this group, and I started going, and I just saw like a lot of people were talking, but nobody was doing anything. I felt like once we left that room, there was no change. So I talked to Amy, and he was like, well, why don't you be the secretary? You know, and then it started from there. And so now I'm co-chairing it.
What's the name of the group?
The Women's Resettlement Working Group, mm-hmm. WRWG.
And how would people find you? Are you online? Do you have a website?
Yep. Google. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Google.
So it's NH New Haven, nhwrwg.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. And we are related to the Fresh Start Project, which mm-hmm. is the city's initiative sure. around reentry. Mm-hmm. And we're basically started as a group of people who were involved in Fresh Start and mm-hmm. said, you know, let's make a group that just is dedicated to mm-hmm. women's issues because mm-hmm. Fresh Start, you know, we wanted to make space just for that, to mm-hmm. hold that space. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that we've done from the beginning with this group, as Jackie alluded to, which really comes from my work with HIV as well. We know that the people who are going to solve the problem are the people who are closely, you know, closest related to that problem. Yep. And that's what we saw with HIV. Mm-hmm. We have a new world right now in terms of HIV because people living with HIV stood up mm-hmm. and fought for it. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're mm-hmm. trying to do with the Women's Reentry Working Group as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all allies. We're all as a community supporting, but we need formerly incarcerated women to lead this movement. They are the people who have experienced this, as Jackie's mm-hmm. describing. She knows what happened to her and what she dealt with coming out. And that's the leadership that we are looking to celebrate and to support to bring us out of this, to help us find better ways.
Was it your experience in the AIDS movement that a turning point was when some high-profile, wealthy people came out and discussed their relationship with the AIDS movement and the HIV movement, and so it gave it a face and it gave it not really credibility, but certainly backing.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Well, I think Jeff, that's a great point. I think you know Jackie could really weigh in on this. I mean, the critical issue with HIV that's also a parallel to the movement to support formerly incarcerated people is stigma. Mm-hmm. When people there's a huge stigma, there was and is, for against people who are living with HIV, which caused those people to cower, to not ask for their rights, to be afraid. And when people push back on that and mm-hmm. own that and said, I am HIV positive,
yes.
and I'm standing in front of you and I'm demanding that you support me. And that's what we need, you know, with formerly incarcerated people as well. There's a tremendous stigma. And I would assert a larger stigma for female than male ex-offenders.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if Jackie, if you want to talk about that, but that's also what we're trying to fight with our group.
Yeah, and Jackie, what kind of obstacles did you face? First of all, when did you come home from prison, and what kind of obstacles did you face when you came home?
December of 2013. Mm-hmm. What obstacles didn't I face? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm blessed in the fact that before my drug addiction started, I had graduated college. So I had an education background to at least support me, but, mm-hmm. you know, unfortunately, whenever you go to job interviews, you know, the first thing they see is that you have a criminal background. Everything good that you've done in your life doesn't matter once mm-hmm. they see that. It's like a black X on you. And for women, and I'm not saying women can't do like vocational, you know, I mean like trades, but that's mainly like a male dominated field. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult for women to get jobs. And you have to throw in, you know, childcare. I mean, when I came home, my mother had passed away when I was incarcerated.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. And she, you know, thankfully my stepdad stepped up to the plate and took care of my son. But when I came home, I was just thrust into childhood. Now, I mean, motherhood. Now, before that, I was a heroin addict running the streets. So I came home to a 3-year-old running around, you know, who wants a mother. And it was very overwhelming for me because I hadn't known how to be a mother. I wasn't a mother. You know, I was a drug addict back then. Mm. And so just finding a job and having supports, you know, getting my license. There's just so much. Mm. And it, like I said, if you don't have support, someone in your corner, you know, fighting along with you or like picking you up when you're feeling down, it's very easy to just slip back into the buckets and go back to what you know.
Mm-hmm. I find this whole conversation interesting because it is World AIDS Day, and I come from AIDS Project New Haven. I was an associate director at AIDS Project New Haven, and so I understand it. And I was doing it at the time when it was at the height of the frenzy around HIV and AIDS, mm-hmm. and working with Elsie Cofield, who was trying to bring the church, the religious community into the fold with AIDS Interfaith. And so I remember thinking about how desperate these times were and how black and brown people were left out of this dialogue very early on. And now we are pretty much the face of this epidemic.
I mean, the race thing, let's put that out there. I mean, so, for example, we know about 13% of our country is African American.
Yes.
We know about 40% of the people who are incarcerated are African American. And similarly, 40% of the people living with HIV are African American. And that disparity
statistic
is much even greater for women.
Mm. Yes.
So with women, And Babs, you can help me out with this, but I believe it's about 60% of the people living with HIV, women living with HIV, are African Americans. So one of the things that is definitely, you know, like you're saying, these intersections, you know, the fact that we see this disproportionate impact of criminal justice systems on people of color and also HIV, you know, are those phenomenon related and how are they related?
I mean, I think you have to sort of make those correlations because when you overlay housing on top of that, because when you come out of the anybody's penal system and you have to find housing, it's already troubling. If you add HIV or AIDS to that mix, it becomes almost impossible to sort of figure out where you're going to live. And then if you have to throw in getting your kids back, you know, on top of all of that. Yes, people are living much longer with HIV and AIDS. I have friends who from the very beginning are still alive, still with me.
But that's if they're in treatment. And it's focused on treatment.
But that's what it is. They are in treatment and they have wealth. And they have access. Yeah. And so that's a different kind of conversation than if you're just, you know, homeless or whatever and you've got to deal with this and your options are very limited. So,
Amy, how do you deal with issues of privilege when the steps removed are that you're white, you came from a an affluent background or relatively affluent, affluent background, and then it's people of incarceration, people of color, women with HIV. It feels, what's the relatability? How do these people kind of get through all of those barriers to get to relate to you in the message that you're bringing?
For me personally?
Yeah.
Well, those are great questions. I think one thing is just to be, I work every day on my racism and my privileges and just to be aware of them and to think about how they shape my life and my experiences. I mean, for me, what's worked is being genuinely open to hearing other people's stories and making space for other people and not taking up too much space. I think that's really important. And again, that's something I didn't necessarily learn growing up in a primarily white community. I learned it growing up in the HIV community.
Yes.
I learned it from my first mentor, Gene Suarez, who was a Cuban American man. I was living in Miami. Every meeting we went to, Haitian Americans, African Americans, Latinos, gay people, straight people, and watching how this group listened to each other, fought with each other, right? Communicated with each other. That is the community that really raised me in terms of genuinely being authentic about asking what you don't know about, asking when you don't understand something, trying to understand that your way is not the only way and that there are other people, and meeting people with a genuine sense of respect and curiosity about their humanity and what they can offer me. You know, for me, being involved in HIV, and I know this might sound kind of strange to people, but when I think about my activism, it's, you know, of course there's this idea of helping the world, but what I'm really trying to do is help myself. I'm trying to survive my own life, right? And negotiate my own. And I think that's very, you know, I'm not here to save someone else. You know, I'm here, of course, to help and to be part of community, but really just to understand my own self and survive. You know.
Yeah, I think that in this conversation, well, at least early in the conversation, there was a lot of colonialism, a lot of kind of missionary work. You know, do it, you know, we'll save you, but you do have to do it our way.
Right.
Yeah. And now, for example, when I'm interviewed or when I preach, because you know I'm a reverend, and the first thing I have to do is I have to own my social location and put my privilege out there, because if I'm asked, you know, you're a person who went to prison. And I have to let people know that that doesn't mean I know anything whatsoever about what the issues were of someone who grew up in the inner city, for example, and if I pretend I do, then I'm not being authentic and I can't be helpful.
That's just somebody else's experience in prison. You know, it's very different from me. I'm not gonna lie, I was treated very differently because, don't look like your typical addict. You know, I'd always told, like, you don't belong here. You don't, like, who does belong here? You know what I mean? But I was treated differently by corrections officers and staff. You know, I was given, you know, more leeway. I was more respected than some of the other girls, and especially minority girls. And it's not fair at all.
Did you know it at the time? I mean, were you aware of that?
I was aware. Mm-hmm. I think I'm more aware of it now that I'm mm-hmm. home and I'm more active in this community. Mm-hmm. But, you know, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about this work group that you're doing, the resettlement group, because that really was my initial interest in this conversation, because I didn't know of any other group that was talking to women or talking about women who were formerly incarcerated in a very formal sort of way that actually met and was trying to sort of move this needle a little bit around those issues. So talk a little bit about what some of the goals are, what the mission is, and what you hope to accomplish with this. And those who are listening and want to call in, we'll open the phone lines at around 8:40 because this conversation is good, and we'll take your call. So just hang on.
Well, I think one of the mission. Well, first off, I think we lacked a mission in the beginning. We were all there for a common purpose, but we really didn't know what to do. But now we really have a focus on not only helping women as they reenter, but letting them know that they're supported while they're there. So one of the things we're doing right now is sending Christmas cards to women who are going to be, you know, coming back to the New Haven area. We started the Welcome Home Project, which is an initiative. It's a group of us from the WRWG group, and we meet women who are dropped off. For those that don't know, women are just dropped off at the New Haven Police Department and kind of just left to themselves. So it's 5 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning, getting dropped off on Union Ave and told to go on your way. And again, if you don't have any supports or family or whatever to come meet you, it's very overwhelming. So we meet women there and we let them know that if nothing else, you know, we want to see you succeed and you are cared about. And if they're interested, we will connect them with services. We bring them to the TIC Center and act as a support for them. And we also have a group working on clemency issues. As you know, recently there was two clemencies, Panna and I can't remember the other woman's name off the top of my head because we had her nickname. But anyways, so, you know, really working on those issues and bringing a highlight to it, because there's women in there that have been incarcerated since they were 14 years old for crimes they committed as children when their lives were more than horrific. And it's nobody's giving them a voice, and they feel trapped behind those walls. And we're really trying to help, at least, you know, connect these women to resources so they could start that process.
Yeah, I mean, just to build on that, I think Jackie, that was a great summary of what we're doing. As Jackie described, when we first got together, we didn't actually know what we were going to do. But sure. I actually see that as a really important process. So our group's been meeting for 2 years, and part of that was just meeting. You know, just coming together and like we were talking about before, seeing each other, listening to each other, rather than like Jackie and me being like, oh, this is what we're going to do, you know, but really building a group and a community. And that's something I'm very proud of. It may not be that big. It may be 15, 20 people, but we trust each other and we've, you know, developed that working relationship, which is a foundation to build, like Jackie's describing the Welcome Home Project. We've done a lot around housing, because housing, as Babs was describing, is one of our first kind of conversations with the group, everyone, formerly incarcerated women, providers, allies, everyone was talking about housing. And so we did a community assessment to see what is actually out there in terms of housing for formerly incarcerated women. We did a small research project where we interviewed 50 women coming back from.
I saw that on your website. That's a great graphic, too. I'm going to see if I can pull it for
thank
the.
Thank you. I brought it with me just in case.
Hold it up for the camera.
Yeah. So about 70% of the women who have been incarcerated, who returned to New Haven, have an experience of homelessness. And. Well, I have two different graphics. But,
and you have to say why, if you go to jail for drugs and you get kicked out of housing and public housing and specifically, you can't go back. It's hard to go back.
HUD no longer allows people that have felonies. I mean, there's specific programs for people who have been incarcerated or have felonies, but that's limited because I used to be a case manager for the program. But HUD no longer allows felonies, even if they're not drug related. You know, they're not going to give you housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, housing is a super complicated issue that, first of all, in the state of Connecticut, there's very little affordable housing, whether you've been to prison or not. Right. So that's a huge issue that we have in our state.
Yes.
You know, for about 7 or 8 years, I worked with Kim Blankenship, who's a sociologist at the Yale School of Public Health, on this project called SHARP. And we interviewed over 300 people who were coming back from prison to New Haven. This was a federally funded study, talking to them about what were some of the issues that they faced. And we saw really big differences in housing situations for men versus women. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues is exactly what Jackie has just described. Women coming home from prison, the number one place where people live when they come home from prison is with their mom or female or their girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a woman coming home, often her mom's home is not available to her because her kids are living there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or her brothers.
Or, you know, so mm-hmm. with the men, when the men go to prison, their children stay either with their female partner or with their mm-hmm. female partner's, you know, the maternal family.
Family.
So their
yep.
mom is still sort of available for them.
Yes.
Right. But so what we see is for women, the housing opportunities are narrowed because the women in their life, their sisters and their moms are caring for their kids. And some women are not ready to be reunited with their kids. Yeah. First of all, they may not be room in the house. But secondly, they may not be mm-hmm. in a place where they're ready to, like mm-hmm. Jack mm-hmm. was describing, okay. be a mom. And that's, you know. Mm-hmm. So then what are their options? So a lot of housing in low-income communities is controlled by women. So it's harder for women, for men. So the chance that their boyfriend would have a place to live, you know, that's it's not as big of a pathway as we see for men coming back to stay with their girlfriends. What we do see sometimes is women staying with men who they don't necessarily have a relationship with. Mm. And that's a survival strategy.
Sure.
And that's exchanging housing mm-hmm. sometimes for sex. And mm. then that's HIV risk and that's multiple mm. partnerships. And that leads into the other things. Mm. So the point is that housing, like everything, is gendered. Housing opportunities are gendered. Mm. And there's a lot of, and we also have a fewer halfway houses for women in the state of Connecticut.
Yes.
So there's other structural issues, sober houses.
Yes. I was having a conversation with this, with somebody else. I think it might've been with Beatrice Codiani,
yeah, yeah.
who is my dear friend,
yeah.
who I met serving time at Danbury.
Who's a Federal. Founding co-chair of our group. Let me just say, Jackie has come into the role recently, but before it was Beatrice and I who,
Beatrice
you know,
and I
so
are good
she's
friends.
A big part yes. of our group
and,
as well.
And a fellow yes. Just Leadership person.
Yes. So oh, yes, know, yes. Wow, a fellow great. Just Leadership person. So, yeah, she would be the one to know all that kind
yeah.
of stuff. So.
Okay, can I ask a question about this? Are there also legal impediments? It seems to me that, when a woman gets into some kind of trouble, and if it's drugs, for example, and there are children involved, DCF is involved, and so then when a woman comes out of prison, is she prevented from being with her children because they are victims on the case? And there's a time during parole, for example, where recently released inmates can't fraternize with victims that are on their files.
I mean, I can speak from my experience. I mean, I obviously every case is different. In the event that your children are actually, you know, classified as victims, then yeah, there's going to be an issue. But I didn't even have DCF in my involvement. You know, I actually had my son in prison and my parents came, you know, and got my son. But probate court stipulated that I could not have any unsupervised contact with my son, neither me nor his father, mm-hmm. because of our addiction. You know, I mean, you're not making good choices when you're mm-hmm. actively using. So technically, I was supposed to be supervised at all times when I was with my son, you know, and that kind of adds to the stigma, too. And like your feelings of worthlessness and it's like people are like, this is my child. I brought him into this world. And it's like.
So were you involved in the probate proceeding from prison
yes.
or was it done ex parte without you?
No, I was involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have any choices. You know what I mean?
It's, yeah.
You could be involved in it all you want, but your kid's either going to DCF or with family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's oddly enough that my mother was incarcerated 20 some odd years ago, and DCF made it a nightmare for her to get my son because of that. And so, you know, again, that stigma just continues throughout life. But, you know, when DCF has your children, you know, then you have visits that you have to, you know, maintain. But parole's got you going here and there and this group and that group. And it's very difficult. And again, a lot of times, if the children are in the home, because, you know, parole has to approve the house, parole might not approve it. And then what do you do?
So, how
can you, one second, please?
I apologize.
No, that's all right. If you just tuned in to Criminal Justice Insider with Babs Ross-Ivey and Jeff Grant, we are having a conversation today with Amy B. Smoyer, who is Assistant Professor of Social Work at Southern Connecticut State University, and Jackie Lucibello, who is the co-chair of the New Haven Women's Resettlement Working Group, yes. where they both work together doing this work around women in incarceration. So go ahead, Jeff.
I have two questions. The question for Jackie is, I don't think that we've discussed on the show yet what it's actually like when you're in prison, but then you have to participate in some kind of proceeding, for example, a probate proceeding. And what are the what's it actually like? I mean, are you do it from prison? Is it video? Do you have to be transported to a courtroom? What's that about? Do you go there in handcuffs? Do you go there with guards?
Yeah, so again, every case is different. I mean, some things can be done over the phone, but typically, you know, you have to be present for some proceeding. So you're woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, you got to go get strip searched, go through that whole process, and then you're brought down to whatever court it is, and you're shackled, you know, feet, belly chained, hands. And yeah, you're brought in front of the court just like that. And
families there, other people, interested parties.
Yeah, mm-hmm. is present. And, you know, the guards are there with you. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, basically it. It's just like any other court trip.
How did you feel being in that kind of situation? It must have been dehumanizing.
It's more than dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. What's even more, when I went to go visit my mother on her deathbed, I was black boxed. At that time, I had already been approved for parole. I was a level one inmate. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? I had not been in any trouble, and I was literally black boxed.
Can you describe what that is? Yeah. I don't know if people know what black box is.
What black box is that your feet are shackled, and then you have a chain running up from your ankles to your belly, and your handcuffs are attached to a black box, and that chain from your ankles to your belly is also attached to that black box. So you're like immobile. And I was put in a wheelchair, and I was wheeled through the hospital like that, and I was not allowed to see my family, even though the people that were in the room, including my mother, were on my visiting list. They were approved visitors, approved people I could have contact with. They were not allowed to be in the room with me. It was just, I can't even explain to you how dehumanizing it is. I mean, you literally feel like you're an animal.
And this was your father who was passing away?
My mother.
Your mother. And did you get to spend some time with her?
I did, but I had two guards at the door watching my every move. Mm-hmm. And the door had to be open. So I, you know, it's.
And she saw you, she was dying, and she saw you like this.
Yes.
And did she express to you her feelings?
No, she didn't. My mother, I knew I was incarcerated. It was, I just kind of took peace with it that she would rather see me like that than how I was on the streets. You know, at least she knew that was how I got through it. But, you know, it's unnecessary, you know, and it's very, very dehumanizing. But that was a changing moment in my life where I decided that this is what my life has come to. But for women, you know, especially sometimes the children are there at these probate court hearings, whether it's because the guardians don't have, you know, child care or for whatever reason. And, you know, you're there in front of your children. You know, my son was a baby, thankfully, but, you know, they look at you. You know, it's traumatizing for the kids. It's even more traumatizing for you. And then not only that, then you have to leave to go back to a place where you have no support. Nobody gives a shit about you, you know. And now you're, you know, you just gave up your rights or your... You know, you were stripped of your parenthood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just want to, I know we're on radio and we're not allowed to, we have to like keep a lot of sound and everyone's listening, but I would really just like to honor that story that Jackie just told. That's an incredible story.
Incredible, yeah.
And one way we don't hear.
One we don't hear. And an example of what I would call structural violence. Mm. You know, that is a form of structural violence to have somebody who has an addiction problem, a health problem, a mental health problem, and treat them in this way. So that, you know, thank you for sharing.
Yeah,
that.
Thank you for trusting us with that. Yeah.
And I think, you know, another thing is, you know, in thinking about the court run, which is what we're describing, that's what it's called, the court run, when you go out. You know, my research over the last 5 or 6 years, which might sound unbelievable to people, but I've spent the last few years just talking to people about food and eating in prison.
I was just going to talk to you about food.
Yeah. And the reason why I do it is I'm not trying to get everyone to, you know, learn how to cook or lose 10 pounds. It's because it's the same issue that Jackie's talking about. It's about humanity. Mm-hmm. It's about understanding food as a mechanism of power and control, of culture, of relationships. This is how we use food as human beings. And incarcerated people who are also human beings use food in the same way. And so one of the stories about the food and related to the court run, as Jackie was alluding to, you know, they wake them up really early. You get kind of like this bagged breakfast, which is like a milk and something, and then like a weird waffle thing. And then you're taken on the van to the courtroom where you wait all day to see, you know, for your 5 minutes or whatever in front of the judge. And
you're
halfway
shackled that whole time.
You're shackled the whole time. And halfway through that day, they bring you a sandwich, which is white bread, which really, you know,
is the worst
practically
possible.
Illegal in most yeah, right. Yes. Like, I don't know, you know, cracker white bread.
Thing.
You know,
yes,
they're both
right.
Very bad for you. And so it's white bread with a slice of bologna, sometimes a slice of cheese. These sandwiches are actually made at the York Correctional Facility by incarcerated women. And it's a bagged lunch. And this is, you know, this is the core of our democracy, right?
So,
your moment in front
so
of the
Amy,
judge.
Do
and
you
you're
think,
starving when you go.
Do
and
you think that this whole food, because I've been thinking about this food situation in prison, because when I was in Danbury, and I have such a severe food allergy, dairy allergy, that they would not accommodate it. I'd have to figure it out for myself, which
That's
is what
crazy.
I do anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't there long enough for them to sort of to jump through
even
all the
if
paperwork.
You're there one day, like especially, it's a health condition.
I know, but
yeah. And I just want to add to Amy too. They don't give you dinner when you get back.
Right. That's I was going to say that also. Yeah. Then when you get back, there's no dinner. Now you might have someone who you share a cell with who's got some ramen noodles or something that might be able to help you. And people do that because people take care of each other.
Yeah.
And so we see that when there isn't that institutional support, what the women at York have. And I know there's this story about how all women hate each other and everything. That is not true. You know, women are relational and they support each other. And I
Absolutely.
See this every day with the group of HIV positive women who work together and live together at York and face incredible stigma. And they support each other. And so when you come back from the court run, after leaving your child, after signing your rights away, after negotiating that bail deal for something that, you know, all that goes on, I'd like to say that there's a social worker there to process your trauma and someone to talk to you. And, you know, but that's actually not what happens. It's the person who shares, and that is people helping each other. And that is the strength of that institution, is the 971 women who live there and support each other and make it through every day together.
But here's the thing. Here's what I think about this, Amy, is that food is often used as a tool of punishment.
Yes.
Yes.
That it is a tool of punishment. And even though science has already said if you feed people well, if people eat well, their brains develop better, they are better, and they're less likely to do X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a prison and you have a captive audience, why wouldn't you err on the side of nutritious food rather than garbage that continues to sort of feed the foolishness that goes on?
And they say it's money, but all that food goes to waste.
It goes to waste. And it might be an expensive.
And we're already spending a lot of money.
But
so,
it's expensive,
you know,
yeah. For garbage.
Right.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
And like, it's expensive. It's really expensive not to treat people in a humane way. Because
yes.
Then what they do is they come back to prison, you know, and that is what is expensive. So the question is, how can we meet incarcerated people and begin that process of recovery and reentry on the first day? And what is the role that food might play in doing
yes.
that?
Yeah.
You know,
and that's
because
a good point.
Because I think it's a, you know, in I had an opportunity to study for a few months in Denmark, which has a totally different system of, well, everything, and including criminal justice systems. And for them, food is actually the cornerstone of their rehabilitative
wow.
process.
See, that's
in prison.
I saw that,
yeah,
and that's why
yeah.
it got me thinking about
and so
food
they,
as
right.
one of the
restorative.
Lowest recidivism rates.
And it's about,
yes.
it's ultimately, you know, it really gets down to, you know, your perception of the person, right? So a part of it is like, is the food, when you say is food the punishment, some people might say yes, you know, like actually, yeah, let's punish people by giving, you know, so that idea.
Oh, they're
that,
not
like,
deserve, you're not deserving
right.
of good
right.
food, fresh
right.
vegetables.
Right.
You're going to get this process.
So that's the
stuff.
Sort of fundamental question when it comes to incarceration. You know, in Denmark, what they believe, which is what I believe as well, and other people, you know, when you go to prison, what you lose is your freedom.
Mm.
And that is a huge thing. That
yes.
is a huge thing. But in Denmark, you lose that, but you don't lose your right to be with family. You don't lose your right to education. You don't lose your right to eat like a human being. You don't lose the right to have sex with people who you know, you don't lose the right to have intimate relationships. What you have lost is your freedom.
Yes.
And so, but in this country, we say, well, you lost your freedom and all these other things
yes.
and the dignity.
And
but,
you can't ever get them
right.
back.
And
like, we don't want you
right.
to have them back.
And the thing to remember also is that among, you know, and this is true of men too, I think that we haven't studied it as much, but we know this as well, especially for women. Many women who come to prison have a lived experience of trauma in their own lives,
yes.
you know, of sexual assault, of child abuse, mm-hmm. of verbal, emotional, you know, and that trauma.
Horrific traumas.
Horrific traumas. plays into their addiction and some of the reasons why they're... So you have a group of people who are very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And then you're having them eat out of trash cans. You know what I mean? And so it's like that to me really... just, Matt, you know, it's just, so how can we make a trauma, I think when we talk about create, and we talk about this with women a lot, creating trauma-informed, gender-sensitive programs. And I think that begins with the food.
But don't we have very little impact on what we can actually accomplish in the prison setting itself? Unfortunately, but so in community corrections or in the work you're doing outside, this is where you can really make a difference on the ground. And some of these issues that we're talking about, for example, food justice in the prison, it's happening on the outside too, because people, women have limited access because of poverty, because of the situation that they're lack of training, lack of resources. And so this is, we're just perpetuating it on the outside. And then ultimately the cycle of incarceration recurs.
I mean, yes, we have a food justice issue in our community as well. But I mean, I think what happens when we look at the criminal justice system is we become sometimes a little bit paralyzed because it is so big. You know, mm-hmm. where do I intervene? Where can I actually make a difference?
That's a good thing about this particular issue is that you can jump into this pipeline at anywhere
exactly.
and make a difference, whether it's at the early education part of it or at the food part of it or the reentry part of it or the mental health part of it, that people can jump in at any point and make a difference in that particular place so that people don't feel like, oh, my God, we have to take on this whole elephant.
But I think it's that perception, too, that people believe it is the elephant that they get overwhelmed and they feel like they can't make a difference. But if we rally more people, especially formerly incarcerated people, together and work together, you know, our voices would eventually be heard. Eventually something is going to be done. But a lot of people come home and they just want to forget that.
I was just going to ask, like, how hard is it to recruit formerly incarcerated folks to come and do this work? I could tell you for myself how hard it is because I don't have time to do it. Mm-hmm. I have to find ways to do it in a way that makes sense. But if you have to work or report or all this other kind of stuff, this is like the last thing that you want to connect to.
And does it become easier when you choose a disruption point so that it's identifiable? For example, housing. And even by using, if you were there at the beginning of this group, I assume that you chose the word resettlement carefully because America has such a rich resettlement history in New York and in Chicago and Dorothy Day and all of that. So you must have known that that was a disruption point that you were going to be able to have people identify with.
Yeah, and just to recognize the process, the idea of reentry sort of is like, oh, I'm going to open this door and I'm going to go in, you know? And just to sort of, so we felt like resettlement was a bigger word that kind of embraced time and space in a more generous way and really allowed people to see. We got it from Hartford. In Hartford, they use that word at the, up in their work. So, yeah, and I think there are different, I mean, so for example, Beatrice, and there's a lot of people in our state right now who are, you know, I kind of see it in three different ways. One is the no entry. That's what Beatrice works on. And that's the bail reform that we have right now.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, 1/3 of the women who are at York are unsentenced. Okay.
That's crazy.
So part of the challenge.
That's like apartheid.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, but the thing is, it's not an easy, none of this is an easy fix because the problem is for a lot of women, and we've seen this in research and in talking with women, for many women, prison is the safest place they've ever been.
Wow.
And that is.
That just wears me thin.
That is so. So when you have someone who has a low, you know, low. Nonviolent crimes, you know, larceny six, stealing stuff from Home Depot, mm-hmm. selling sex, you know, addiction issues. Okay, so we don't want to put her in prison. But if we leave her in the community, who will hold her?
Oh.
Where will she live? Mm. You know?
Because there's no facilities for that. Mm.
So,
no, right?
So if we say, let's not send her to prison, which I would endorse, we have to have some place for her to go here and to help her. And that's the problem with the bail reform mm-hmm. is like, yes, let's not send the people to jail. But then where's the housing? Where's the support? Mm-hmm. Where's the harm reduction? You know, how do we meet someone who's using, who's selling sex work and saying, come as you are and let's work.
Well, people,
you
know? People are trying to solve this problem.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot.
Definitely.
I just got an email this morning that one group is crowdfunding bail money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, to me, that's a remarkable place we are, where people are looking at technology and they're looking at the problem and how can we take this problem on ourselves.
Well, I'll go you one better than that, Jeff. Somebody just created an app that people can download onto their phones and help pay for people's bail.
Yeah,
right.
It's
just
it.
About
right.
anywhere.
But again, the question is, so you paid their bail, but then where are they going?
Them, right?
You know what I mean? Because what we want to do is make them safe, right? And help them to... So it's not actually enough to pay some... I mean, it might be. For some people, they say, look, you pay my bail, I got a place to go and it, you know, I'm going to be... But just to make sure that you know, because sometimes you see judges, right, sending people to prison kind of for their own good, right? This idea that, you know, and unfortunately for some, you know, I just think about the women that I work with now in the HIV positive group, all of them at the time of their arrest, you know, it did in some way save their lives, you know, that they...
Mine. I was
that
on
they,
a mission to nowhere good. Yeah. And honestly, if I stayed out there any longer, I probably would have died.
So are you the exception, or at least are you the exception as someone who recognizes that it saved your life? And how do you, as a reformer, as a person in, you know, in this industry, how do you reconcile the fact that you're a prison reformer or a proponent of no entry, and yet prison saved your life? So how do you reconcile all that?
Well, prison saved my life, but I was never given any other opportunities. Mm-hmm. That
that's a good point.
I was never
that's
offered a program, mm-hmm. ever. The prosecutor wanted me away for 10 years, excuse my language. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I was never offered any other opportunities. Mm-hmm. So I can't say for sure whether or not they would have, you know, saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily prison itself that saved me.
Right.
It was the trauma and the experiences I went through, mm-hmm. during that time, mm-hmm. that, you know, who's to say it wouldn't have changed me here either.
Yeah.
That community support.
Yeah,
did you
have to fashion your own rehabilitation basically in prison?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So can you talk about that for a second?
I personally believe jail rehabilitates nobody. And I did the inpatient program up there twice. It was a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really the women who... You know, again, people think, you know, prison is like this orange is the new black sort of thing. And, you know, the women are very supportive. And it was a lot of the, you know, old timers who really, you know, guided me and helped me and shared their, you know, experience, strength and hope and, you know, really took the time and invested it in me, especially when my mother passed away, especially when I had to give away my son.
Were you in the writing program there? I know Bonnie Forshaw talks about that experience.
Yeah. And it's those women who really... you know, pick you up and get you through and kind of start to change your mindset.
Mm.
And one, because they've been there and they understand it. And you know what I mean? It's,
it's,
like they say, an addict helping another addict without parallel. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you understand my pain, my despair, we're walking in the same steps.
Yeah. Babs, how are we doing for time?
We have to go now.
Oh.
We have to go now because we got another show after this. I'm actually doing World's AIDS Day with, Dolores Greenlee, who is the Assistant Director of Infectious Diseases at the Cornell Hill Health Center.
Great.
So
great.
I get to talk more about this all day today. So thank you so much, Amy.
Yeah,
thank
wonderful.
You. Thank
and,
you. I hope
and
we can come back.
Jackie,
still got
you
a lot
better
more
come
to
back.
Cover. Yes,
yeah. There's so much
back.
To talk about.
Yeah.
There's so much to talk about.
This wasn't so tough, was it?
No.
No, I would love for you to come back so that we could talk more about food and social justice
for sure.
And all that. I think it would be really, really good. And thank you, Jeff.
Babs, love you, Babs. Thank
next
you.
Week, the next time we do this, which will be December 15th, our guest will be the Katal Center Executive Director, Lorenzo Jones, right?
Mm. Lorenzo will be here.
So he'll be here and we'll be talking about this. If you tuned in, you can catch us again at 5 o'clock on the drive home, or you can download us at SoundCloud. This is the Criminal Justice Insider on 103.5 FM, WNHH, live streaming on the newhavenindependent.org, sponsored by the Community Foundation of Greater New Haven, now more than ever, and the community family reentry. Jeff,
serving the justice community since 1984.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Babs.
I'll see y'all soon. Have a nice one.
Have a great day.
I don't think we have any music, Harry.
What to sing?